Thanks, Alex. This, yes, I mean, this is just a title. I'm not sure what it will be exactly. I was sort of going, preparing the slides mostly in the airplane yesterday. And it somehow evolved a little bit on the message that I want to convey, which I think is good, because then it may be more interesting. Here's a little bit of an overview. Indeed, I will start out with a bit of introduction and notation, but already Adrian did most of that, so I don't have to say much there. I will say a little bit about the no-go theorem and the proof, and then actually I want to focus mostly on the connection with other stuff that I did and other people did, complexity theory, ADS-CFT, and I will have one slide on that, and Alex will, where's Alex? He left. Okay. Very good. We can tell a joke now. And then a bit on cryptography, classical cryptography, and then I will end with catalytic computation. And I have something prepared on experiments, but I probably will not reach that. But there will be some talks later this week on experiments. For example, Wolfgang is here. And I think Eric will also say a bit about that together with Paul. Yeah. Okay. So. Then I decided to put somehow, because when I was going through the slides, I said, "Oh, I'm using this theorem, and I haven't cited it, and that theorem." So I decided to put a list of people that I worked with or talked to, and then the list became really big, and now I'm afraid that people are missing that should be on the list. So it's not in alphabetical order, and so if you didn't see your name, it was there, but you just couldn't spot it fast enough. Okay, so introduction, position verification, and indeed I want to zoom into the one-dimensional case where we're trying to figure out whether someone is at a specific location. They don't share a secret password, as Adrian has somehow suggested. So I'm still with the old model where that's not the case. So there's a line. And on this line, there's someone whose position you're trying to verify, and there are these two verifiers. And then there is a prover, which we shouldn't call a prover, I learned today, but I don't know how to call it otherwise. But Adrian suggests something else. And this prover is claiming to be at a certain location on the line, not necessarily in the middle. The prover and the verifiers engage in a protocol, and it's sort of these protocols that are interesting and that we are going to examine. And we have some assumptions that the communication is at the speed of light, the computation is also instantaneous, and the verifiers can coordinate as much as they like. And then you have to shield yourself, or you have to protect yourself, or the protocol is secure if no coalition of fake provers can spoof that you are, that there is somebody at this blue location, in reality there isn't someone. So there are Alice and Bob, who are the spoofers, and they're trying to intercept the messages and convince the verifiers that there's somebody at the blue location, but there isn't. Okay, and then I actually noticed this morning when I came in early that Parameter Institute already is working on this, even from a technological point of view. Because when I walked in, I saw that they're working already on these verifiers. I don't know if you noticed them, but they were sitting there downstairs. But there are many pointing into somehow the same direction. And I don't think you need that many, so we can prove to them that that's not necessary. This is the model, and here is somehow the most general protocol that you can imagine in a single round. So Alice and the verifiers send density matrices, rho A and rho B, from some joint state to the prover. This is all quantum information. Then the prover is supposed to do some unitary operation on these density matrices, resulting in two other density matrices that are being sent back to the verifiers. And then everything has to time out in the right fashion so that the location of the prover is determined and verified, and cannot this computation could not have arisen at another point in space. And indeed, as Adrian's already told you, this is not unconditionally possible. There are always attacks possible on this. And so here's an Alice and a Bob that are attacking this. And I would like to view this attack of Alice and Bob as a game. And it sort of looks something like this. Alice and Bob, they share entanglement. They got each part of a state of a larger density state of a quantum state rho AB. Alice got the A part, Bob got the B part. They have some entanglement. And then they send messages to each other, which are also quantum messages. And no, there's no timing here. And it's important, though, that the messages are independent so that the message that Bob sends is sent before he received the message of Alice and the other way around. So they cannot depend on each other. And then they produce the desired output state, tau AB, or at least the parts thereof. All right, this is the game that Alice and Bob have to solve in order to spoof the position verification protocol. And I like the music of Bach, and there's all kinds of inversions in it, sort of changing stuff around. And I call this the first inversion of the QPV paradigm, because instead of thinking hard and designing a protocol that is secure, we're now actually thinking hard to solve this game, right? So we switched the role of being secure in trying to attack. And so this game here is sort of what I call the first inversion, and there will be a second one that is here. And in a way, this morning I woke up early, and it's also very prominent present in computational complexity theory, where the goal is to find good algorithms for a particular problem. So that's sort of one role that you want to play. But then at some point you want to know, is my algorithm optimal? And then you have to switch roles and try to prove that indeed this is optimal. And somehow going back and forth between these two roles is very important. And this is sort of changing roles here and going from making a secure protocol to attacking a protocol. Okay, and as Adrian already said, this protocol can be attacked, can be won with an exponential amount of entanglement. And indeed, we first had a proof that had a double exponential amount of entanglement, but there's a much more elegant and easier proof due to Beji and Koenig that I want to show to you quickly. And it makes use of this port-based teleportation. You probably all have heard what port-based teleportation is, but let me quickly go through it nevertheless. So normal teleportation is what we all really know very well. So you have your unknown state psi, you do Bell measurement, and you have on an EPR pair, and on the other side you have a corrected if you do the corrections depending on the two Pauli on the two bits C1 C2, you do the Pauli corrections, then you get back psi again. And port-based teleportation is trying to do the same thing. So you're trying to send psi across to the other side using now many EPR pairs. And you do some more complicated measurement here, which gives you a value I. And then what happens is that the state that you want to teleport happens to sit on the ith EPR pair on the other side. But the advantage is that you don't have to correct anything anymore. It's just sitting there as it was put at the beginning here. So no correction needed. There is a little bit of an error, so this is not perfect, but as you grow the number of EPR pairs at play, the error gets smaller, so that's really not an issue. But there is somehow a scaling issue. If you want to send n qubits across with normal teleportation, then you only need n EPR pairs, but if you do that with port-based teleportation, then your resources blow up exponentially, and you need 2 to the n EPR pairs to send across an n qubit system. So it doesn't scale as nice as normal teleportation. So here's the proof of Beji and Koenig from 2011. Remember, this is the attacking game where Alice and Bob get density matrix rho A, rho B. They have to apply some unitary on that to produce tau AB. So here's what happens. In the first step, Alice teleports her state, rho A, across to Bob. By the way, this I'm telling it as if it's a story that takes time. Of course, this all happens instantaneously in one go. Bob now receives a sort of a the rho A, but now with an error on top of it. So I wrote rho A tilde and rho B, and is port teleporting this back to Alice. And doing that, it will end up on one of the ports of Alice's site, although she doesn't know where. But Bob knows that it is on the ith port where the correct state rho A tilde rho B sits. Then Alice, not unaware of where the right one sits, applies the unitary on all of the ports. And on the right port, on the ith port, she has actually done the right thing, and she has actually produced tau AB. And now she sends, on the ith one, she has produced the tau AB. And now she sends all the tau B parts to Bob, and Bob just merely sends I. And then when they have when both know it's I, and when both received all the tau, when Bob receives all the tau B parts, he can output tau that pick out the ith one, and Alice can pick out the ith one as well and produce tau A. So this is an attack that always works, no matter how complicated the U's are, and no matter what the rows are. As you can see, because of port-based teleportation, this scales exponentially. So there always is an exponential attack that works for this scheme. So it's cannot be unconditionally secure. Okay, so that's sort of how things stand, and that's unfortunate, because I do think, Adrian, that people were believing, but maybe I'm putting you on the spot now, that it was possible to do this unconditionally secure, but just that the protocols weren't smart enough to capture this.
Are you asking whether I believe it?
Yes.
No.
No.
I didn't believe it.
Liar.
I didn't disbelieve it. We left it as an open question after that. It's even interesting to set as an open question in the second paper.
It was interesting because there were other schemes around, not just yours, but from other people, and they were sort of convinced that they were secure at some point, and then this sort of blew it all away. I do remember that we chatted about this actually here in Canada in Toronto. Ontario Art Gallery. Is that good? Yes. Well, let's not talk about that part, Adrian. but I had to convince you that this was indeed correct. You were doubting, or at least you needed to be convinced. Let's put it that way. Anyhow. But the big question I think that sort of is ahead of is this optimal? So is this exponential overhead necessary, or can you do with much less? So in particular, does there exist a protocol for which the attack requires lots of EPR pairs, but an honest prover and verifiers are efficient? Now, because if this is the case, then you would in practice still have almost unconditional secure QPV protocols. Depending on how much EPR pairs are many. And question two is, once you have somehow a little bit of an idea of question one, can you actually produce these protocols in reality? Can you do experiments? And so that's question two, which I will not say much about, but a lot of people have been thinking about this and are working on this. And I think this is very interesting. In particular, in with respect to question two, when I started to talk, for example, to Wolfgang, who's sitting over there with shall we implement something like this, then for me this was very, very interesting and an eye-opener, because a lot of things that I didn't know couldn't be done. So That's just a message that Wolfgang told me, no, this is not possible. For example, if you have fiber, then the speed of light through fiber is 2/3 the speed of light. It's not the speed of light, so I didn't know that. But that sort of made sort of screwed up a lot of the protocols that we had just right there. Okay, so indeed, photon losses, errors, and actual speed of light, etc., are problematic. But in the meantime, I've learned a little bit, and it's a very interesting journey. You want to say something? No? Okay. So here's a protocol that I think is kind of very interesting, and it's due to Adrian and his friends, which I called SQPF, but then Alex calls it F-routing. I think F-routing is much nicer, so let's call it F-routing. And here's how it is. And I don't know, Adrian, you didn't even give it a name, so that... and here's how it goes. So we have a on the verifier zero side, there's classical information and bits that are being sent to the prover and some unknown qubit state, psi, well, unknown to the prover, but known to the verifiers. And verifier one is sending only classical information, y. And then under the hood, so known to everyone, is a Boolean function, f, that depends on both x and y. And that can be evaluated efficiently by the prover. And so once the prover receives x and y, he can compute what f of x, y is. And then depending on whether the function is 0 or 1, he either routes, and hence the name f routing, the qubit either back to verifier or onwards to verifier 1, if f of x, y is 1. And otherwise, he routes it back to verifier 0 if the function value is 0. And the nice thing of this protocol is that there's only a single qubit at play, so the quantum information is very little. And furthermore, there's a lot of classical information going on. And the intuition that we have, and I think that's still true, is that as x and y, as the classical information grows, and you can actually prove that this is true, the amount of entanglement that's needed to break this also grows. So the quantum information is only one qubit, but the depending on more and more classical information, more and more entanglement is needed to break this. And here's the attacking game for Alice and Bob for F-routing. Alice receiving X and Psi, Bob receiving Y. They sent a message to each other. And then at the end of the day, Bob has to produce F of X. If F of XY is 1, Bob has to produce Psi. And if F of XY is 0, Alice has to produce Psi. And we're sort of interested in the minimum number of qubits of a joint state, psi AB, that's needed in order to successfully accomplish this task. And this I denote E of F. So E of F is for F, the amount of entanglement needed to break or to solve this game, to successfully solve this game. And as I said, if X and Y grow, hopefully E of F will grow as well, meaning that you need more and more entanglement, and hopefully F is not too complicated. But this is sort of a very pleasant thing to look at and interesting. And somehow there's a little bit of computer science intuition that I think I share with Florian, and that is that somehow the amount of entanglement should grow with the amount of space that is needed to compute F for some reason. And I try to make it more precise than just an intuition, and I really couldn't. But somehow, because the state psi has to be on the right side, on the zero side or on the one side, before Alice knows what the value F of XY is, somehow it feels that you need to at least have the space needed to compute F of XY of entanglement to do this. And indeed, we somehow could show a little bit, and I will say a little bit, that if indeed the space usage is low, then indeed you don't need that much much entanglement. So the amount of entanglement to F route F is 2 to the S of F. And the big so this is what I will show in a moment. And the big question is there an F such that E of F is exponential? This we have no idea whether that's true or not. So that's very funny. Even for random Fs, we don't know how to prove that it's exponential. The best we can do is to show that it is linear, at least. So it grows at least linear for f's. But it should grow exponential, actually, I think. But that we were not able to show. And moreover, we would like to have an f. Moreover, if we have an f that's in P but not in log space, then actually, and that f, for that f, we could show that it grows more than polynomial. This would be really what we're after, right? We want to have an f that's efficient, that actually needs lots of entanglement. And somehow this situation, where we cannot prove anything very strong on f, even for random functions, we see back in cryptography in private simultaneous messages. I will tell you what it is later on, in a conditional disclosure of secrets in secret sharing protocols, and also in a sort of a purely classical topic that I've been working on together with actually Richard Cleave, who's sitting here in the audience as well, called catalytic space, and hopefully I will be able to say a bit about that. Okay, so the first tool that we developed is called the garden hose game. This was when Florian was still a master student, and I think these pictures are still from your master's presentation that I stole. And so that was actually a lot of fun. And here's the model that we looked at, called the garden hose model. Again, you can recognize this function f, the Boolean function f here. But now there's nothing quantum so far. There's just an Alice and a Bob. They receive an input x and an input y. And between them, they have water pipes, these hoses. And Alice also has a water tap that she can connect to these hoses. They're not allowed to talk to each other. But what they are allowed to do is have pieces of hose that they can sort of pairwise connect up these ends of these hoses, like, for example, like this. This one's connected to that one, and this one's connected to that one, and so on. And now what happens is Alice turns on the water, and then the water comes out on one side or the other side. It always will come out on one side or the other side. And the game, or the garden hose complexity for this particular f, is that if f is 0, the water has to flow out on Alice's side, and f is 1, the water has to flow out on Bob's side. And the goal is the garden hose complexity of f is the minimum number of pipes that achieve this. So it's a very sort of a combinatorial setting, and you can think about it, and you can even make little demos of that. And there is a relationship with entanglement uses this E of F value for this F routing game and garden hoses, and that's the following. If I have a garden hose protocol for F, then out of that I can actually extract a attack a game for the F routing protocol. And here's what you do. The qubit to which Alice so we have these pipes, and these pipes we replace by just ordinary EPR pairs, and then the EPR pair that Alice performs a teleportation operation with, or a Bell measurement, is exactly that one to which Alice would have connected the water to. And then whenever we have a piece of hose between pipe I and pipe J, then we do a Bell measurement, or a teleportation measurement between these two ends of the EPR pairs, right? So we just do exactly what the garden hose protocol describes, but now we do it as teleportation measurements on the qubits, on the ends of the qubits. And it's not hard to see that at the end of the day, Bob tells all the outcomes of the Bell measurements to Alice plus the value of y, and Alice tells to Bob all the outcomes of her Bell measurements and the value of x. And then when they both have that, they can go back to the drawing and to their garden hose model and follow how the water has flowed between them back and forth. And that was exactly how this state psi was teleported back and forth between them. And so, since if the function is 1, Bob will have the water coming out, it means that he will have the state coming out, and he needs to correct them with the bell measurement and vice versa. If the water came out on Alice's side, then she can, using the corrections of the bell measurement corrections of Bob and her own, correct the qubit and recover it. So you see that if you have a good garden hose protocol, then you have a good attack. So the things are not equivalent. You can show that there are exponential gaps between the garden hose complexity and this quantity E of F. But what happens if you give them entanglement on top of that? So you have the garden hose model plus entanglement. And I think we knew, but I'm not sure. So I put it up as an open question, but we can maybe solve that quickly or ask Florian what whether this is equivalent or at least interesting at least. But I think we should re-examine. And so this garden hose complexity is interesting. You can easily show that every function has exponential garden hose complexity. And here's how you do that. If you have a function f arbitrary, then you can have 2 to the n plus 1 pipes. Here they are. And what Bob does is, for each of these pipes, he just, there's 2 to the n of them, he just assumes that the value of x is the value that is that corresponds to that particular pair of pipes. So this is pipes with all zeros, and here at the bottom are the pipes which corresponds to all ones as input. And for each of these, he computes whether f of x, corresponding f of I to that pipe, is with the y that he has in his hands is zero. And if it's zero, then he connects up these two pipes. And if it's not zero, he doesn't connect them up. And Alice, she just attaches the water pipe, the water tap, to the pair of pipes that corresponds with index to the input she has, input x. And now what happens if the function is one, then this particular pipe, set of pipes, is not connected because f of xy is one, so Bob will not connect them, and the water will flow out on. Hold on, what happened? And the water will flow out. Where did it move? If it's one, the water will flow out on Bob's side, but if it's zero, then that part of the pipe is connected, and the water will flow out on Alice's side. There we go. Okay, very good. So any function can be done with 2 to the n plus 1 pipes. And moreover, and I will show a little bit on how that works, if the function f is in log space, then the garden hose complexity actually is polynomial. We will show something slightly weaker and then show how to upgrade it to this statement, namely, if the function is in NC1, and I will say in a moment what NC1 is, then the garden hose complexity of f is polynomial. And NC1 is the class of Boolean functions that you can compute with polynomial-sized circuits. So that are circuits like this one that have AND gates and OR gates and NOT gates, that there's only polynomially many of them. And moreover, the longest path from the output gate to the input is logarithmically. So it's a log-deep circuit. And this is called NC1 complexity class. And we will show that if your function f is computable in NC1, then the garden hose complexity is polynomial. And a little bit of complexity eggs here. Here we see this class NC1. And we see it is contained in log space, which is contained in polynomial time, which is contained in NP. And these complexity classes are probably familiar with you. But we don't know whether NP is equal to NC1 or not. So all of this could be just NC1. We don't believe that's the case, but it could be. And what we will show is that F is in log space. Well, then the entanglement usage for this F routing protocol is polynomial, can be done with polynomial number of e-bits. And under the hood here is an important theorem due to David Mix Barrington, which he did in 1989. And somehow this theorem is coming back all the time to me in one form or another. And as we will see, it will come back later on as well in this talk. But what Barrington showed is that NC1, so this class what I just discussed, is equal to another class called branching programs, permutation branching programs of polynomial size. I will explain what they are, where the permutations are coming only from 5 elements for the set S5. And here's what a permutation branching program is of size k. So there is an input x, n bits, and then there are instructions, and each instructions, and there are k of them, and each instructions has 3 ingredients. The first one is a index to one of the bits of the input, so it's a value between 1 and n. And the second and the third ingredient of each instruction are permutations of 5 elements. One is labeled with 0, and the second one is labeled with 1. And so I have k instructions of these triplets, right? So an index pointing to a bit of the input, plus 2 permutations, think of it that one is the input bit is 0, and the other if the input bit is 1. So there they are. And now how do I evaluate such a branching program, permutation branching program on an input? I do the following. If indeed the input bit that is indexed by this value ij, so that's bit xij, if that's 0, then I pick the first permutation, sj0, and if it's 1, I pick sj1. So depending on whether the input bit is 0, I pick the first permutation or the second one. And now I concatenate them all, I compose them like that. And now there is a guarantee that either this is this permutation, right, which is the composition of these permutations that we just picked, either is the identity permutation on 5 elements, or it's some fixed other 5 cycle. I mean, that's sort of what's guaranteed when you get a branching program of this types, of this type. And we say that if it's the identity permutation, then the branching program accepts X. So then it says X is in, is yes. And if it's a 5 cycle, a fixed one, then it rejects. So this is a mode of computation using these permutations. For example, here I have a list, a branching program of 3 instructions. And suppose I have an input that has 2 bits, 0 and 1. Then the permutation that comes out is S1. One, right? Because the first instruction says look at bit 2. If I look at bit 2, it's 1. So that means that I have to pick the second one of these permutations. So that's sigma 1, 1. Then I look at the second instruction that says look at the first bit, which is 0. So I pick permutation S2, 0. And then the third instruction says look at bit 2 again, which is 1. So I pick the third permutation sigma 3, 1. And so now, composing these 3 permutations, I either get the identity permutation, in which case I accept, or I get a fixed 5 cycle, in which case I reject. Okay, and so actually it's interesting, you need 5 elements and you cannot do it with 4. And the reason why you need 5 is that S5 is the smallest group of permutations that's not solvable, and that's sort of a property that's needed in the proof of Barrington's of Barrington that shows this equivalence. Okay, now how do we go from this to our garden hose model and eventually to entanglement? And here's how we go. So in the garden hose model, remember we had Alice who had X and Bob who had Y. And without loss of generality, we have instruction and we have a branching program that computes the function f of x, y that Alice and Bob have. And without loss of generality, we may assume that these instructions somehow alternate between pointing to x and to y that Alice and Bob has. And now here's how it goes. Alice and Bob, for each set of instructions, they reserve 5 pipes. Okay, so we have this branching program that computes the function f of xy. And we have these pipes that are this 5n. 5 polynomial n pipes for each instruction, there's 5 pipes. And now what happens is that Alice connects, depending on her first instruction, she connects the water pipe to what the first, whether she looks, which of the 2 permutations she have to look. and she looks at where the value of 1 is mapped to. So that's a permutation on 5 elements, and element 1 is mapped to some place, and that's where she connects the water to these pipes. And then Bob, what he does is he looks at the second instruction, which talks about his y, and it talks about index y2 of i2 of his y's. And depending whether that's a 0 or 1, he picks out this permutation or that permutation. And he connects up the pipes according to that permutation. So he connects the 5 elements that belong to that permutation. He connects up the pipes in that way. And then it continues. Alice does the same thing. No, this has stopped as well. It's my computer, really. That's very slow. So they continue back and forth to connect up these blocks of 5 pipes according to their branching programs. And then at the very end, if the branching program computed some particular final permutation sigma, and if that sigma is the identity, then the function was 1. And if that sigma was some fixed 5 cycle, the function was 0. And so if that function was 1, and so what you do is you add another 4 pipes. So if the function was the identity, then the water would flow out on this pipe, because it was the total thing was the identity. So that means that where the water entered in 1, it comes out here. And if it wasn't the identity, then these 4 pipes routed back to Alice. So this shows that if your function is in NC1, then the garden hose complexity is polynomial, and hence this entanglement is polynomial. Yes, Richard?
Are you assuming that the branching program, the variables alternate between those?
Yes.
X and Y?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and you can assume that without loss of generality, because if there would be on Alice's side 2, then she can sort of combine that in one permutation. Yes. And this proof you can actually extend to get all of log space by, instead of using 5 elements, use the set of n elements, and then this whole proof that Barrington gave works actually for log space. So there exists a function f, which we were able to show as well, that actually requires exponential garden hose complexity. So that is actually something we can prove for garden hose, which we cannot prove for these other things. For a couple of functions, we proved the garden hose complexity is linear. And note that if we could get a function f in P for which this entanglement value is bigger than polynomial, then we would settle a complexity question P is not equal to L. In particular, these eggs that I drew, like starting with NC to NP, that would be actually not collapsing. So that would be a major result. And the question, does such an F exist, is somehow what is on my mind and has been on my mind. And then Alex sort of came along together with Queer, and they somehow started doubting me, or started making me doubt a little bit, but not enough, but a little bit. And that is this nice connection with ADS-CFT that Alex and Queer, I bet, will talk about a little bit, probably not a little bit, but a lot about. And the idea is the following, that you have this correspondence between sort of anti-de Sitter space in the bulk and conformal field theory. And somehow, if you look at it and squint your eyes, at least that's what I do, and forget about all the mathematics and all kinds of Taganaki conjectures and whatnot, then you can see that this somehow implements a honest quantum position verification protocol, whereas right here you see these things that are downstairs, and here's the honest prover that's sort of in the middle. And on the other hand, this correspondence says that this whole protocol can be simulated on the boundary, and then again, if you look at it in a smart way and you duplicate Alice's and Bob's, you can sort of see that this actually is an attacking game for the honest QPV protocol. And moreover, this correspondence says that this game can be played with not a lot of entanglement, actually, with linear. So for easy functions, somehow it seems to suggest that this requires only linear amount of entanglement to break. But there's no real construction. There's lots of assumptions and unproven conjectures. And in a way, the no-go theorem that I showed to you sort of is in line with ADS-CFT. And moreover, I mean, if you would believe it to the fullest, it would say every function in P will have this value for F routing to be polynomial. But then Alex came to visit, and we were looking at what happens to these other problems in crypto that we actually had the same barrier that that we have for this F routing entanglement attack problem. Does ADS-CFT have some bearing on that, or at least can we say something about that? And that's what we started looking out and sort of got to study a little bit of classical cryptography, namely this thing called conditional disclosure of secrets, which is the following thing, but again, a different topic. Again, we have Alice and Bob, but now we don't have a prover, but it's called a referee. And Alice has input X, Bob has input Y, and a secret bit S, not known to the referee. And moreover, they share a bunch of random bits. And there is a Boolean function under the hood, again, known to everyone here. And Alice is allowed to send a message to Bob, to the referee, and Bob is also allowed to send a message to the referee, just one, and they cooperate. Alice and Bob here cooperate, and they just want the following thing, that the referee only learns the secret value S if and only if the function value of f of xy is 1. So if f of xy is 1, then the referee should know what S is, and otherwise should have no knowledge whatsoever on what S is. Actually, it's surprising, but this can be done unconditionally, with unconditional security. So this is something that you can achieve, always. But the goal is, of course, to minimize the size of the messages that Alice and Bob sent to the referee. And what's known is that any function can be solved with exponential size, CDS scheme, conditional disclosure of secrets. And moreover, for functions in counting L, and I will show you in my eggs diagram where that lies, actually there are polynomial size of these schemes, so the messages are of polynomial size. But the same thing as with this entanglement value for F routing holds, only linear lower bounds are known, and there are actually functions not in P that do that seem to be not in P that allow polysize CDSs. So a little bit more is known here. And actually turned out, when we sort of thought about it long enough, that if you want to come up with a quantum version of this conditional disclosure of secrets, then actually this is just an attack on an F routing scheme. It's just exactly the same thing. So in a quantum version, and I will show you why that is, in a quantum version we still have classical inputs X and Y. We have some shared state psi, AB, so no, instead of random bits you have quantum resources, and the messages that are sent to the referee are now quantum, and of course this is no longer a bit but can be a qubit that is secret. But you still want that the referee learns this qubit only if the value is 1 of F. And what we showed in our paper is that conditional disclosure of secret schemes implies quantum disclosure of secret schemes, and this is more or less equivalent to F routing. And here's how it goes. So we have X and Y, we have our secret qubit S, we have our shared state, well, that should be phi IB. And there is some quantum message that is sent from Alice to the referee, and some quantum message that's sent from Bob to the referee. And the referee learns this qubit if and only if the value of FXY is 1, right? This is sort of what a quantum CDS is. And of course, we want to minimize the number of qubits that are sent from Alice and Bob to the referee. So here's how it goes. First, you purify this protocol, if there is one available. Remember, we want to make an F routing attack out of this. So here it's purified. And here are the messages MXY, MX, MY, the joint state. And they would somehow, these are sort of the purified versions of this whole protocol. And now, here's how we make an F routing protocol out of it. what Bob does is he keeps this register MY and sends on the rest of this purified part to Alice. And Alice sends the register MX to Bob and keeps the rest. This is what they do. And now note that this MX and MY are the old row X and row Y that would have been sent to the referee. And so if the function value is 1, the fact that the referee could recover S means that Bob now can recover from row X and row Y what this value S is. And remember, in the F-routing attack, Bob needs to be able to generate psi if the function value is 1, and if the function value is 0, Alice has to be able to produce it. And so now what happens if the function value is 0, then actually something nice happens. Then, because this is a secure conditional disclosure of quantum secrets, it means that Bob has no information on what this S is. And then there is a nice theorem that says that in that case, Alice has to be able to extract from this part what that secret bit, qubit S is. Right? So almost straightforwardly, by purifying a quantum CDS, you get an F-routing protocol out of it, which is actually very nice and a bit surprising that for us at least that this came out so nicely. And then we sort of tied together a lot of other of these notions. And here you see sort of a scheme. We're not going into detail here, but there's other notions that somehow have nice relationships with F-routing. And I sort of call this the second inversion of today, because what now happens is that we want protocols for position verification. Then inversion 1 gave us this nice game, this attack. And now we have a new inversion that says if you have a secure protocol for another cryptographic task, then that means that you have an attack for a protocol that you wanted to have secure. So it's sort of doubling up. So security of a classical scheme or of another protocol implies insecurity of this quantum position verification, which I think is quite nice. And as I already said, okay, this is inversion 2. This is really also something that this second inversion happens in complexity theory, because remember, you want upper bounds and lower bounds there. You want to prove that algorithms have an optimal algorithm. And it's very hard to prove lower bounds. But there is also a theme that says if you have very good algorithms for something else, then this implies lower bounds for other complexity classes. So this theme is also prominently there. I was wondering, maybe there actually is some connection between these two settings, but I don't know. That's just some musings, right? Some reflections that I'm having.
Harry, what do the blue arrows represent?
I think if you have one, then it implies that the other thing is.
The blue arrow from CDS to CDQS means if you have a protocol for CDS that uses, you know, M random bits, then you have a protocol for CDQS that uses M EPR bits.
Right.
Okay. Means, yeah. Good. You have a good thing at the top of the arrow, it means a good thing at the bottom of the arrow.
The same resources.
Okay, some consequences. actually, so it shows that for every F, you don't need exponential, but 2 to the square. Well, the square root of 2 to the n amount of EPR. We even had better things now.
It should be root n.
It should be, actually, I had root n, but then the root didn't show and I changed it into this, that's why. So it's 2 to the square root of n that you have there. For example, for this function quadratic residuosity, we get that there is a polynomial attack, so E of QR is polynomial. And actually, I want to say a little bit more of the thing. So this is sort of a function that is not believed to be in NC, but for which there is a good attack. And actually, if it is M is a composite, then actually it's not even to believe in P, but in BQP. So this is sort of a funny outlier of our theory that it should be log space. But more interesting, if F is in sharp L, then you get that the entanglement usage for F is polynomial. But it's still not known whether for every F in P this is the case. I don't think that's true though, but we'll sort of maybe find out this week. who is right here. Okay, let's go to the eggs. Here, here we have the what we had so far. Now we paint in non-deterministic log space and counting L, and instead of having F in log space, we now have that, oh, this should be small f, that if F is in sharp L, then it has polynomial entanglement attacks. So we've gone a little bit up the complexity hierarchy here, but we're still far away from P. And what I sort of wanted to go to show is go a little bit further, namely to complexity class TC1, which contains this sharp L, and show that for this complexity class, if F is in there, then it allows for polynomial attacks. I don't know how to show this, but what I do want to show, but I do think it is somehow related to this last theme that I want to talk about, which is catalytic log space. Can I say a little bit about this, Chairman? I started late also.
You also had many technicals.
Yeah. And actually, we don't show that catalytic log space is in P, but we showed it's in ZPP, which is in NP. But morally, ZPP is equal to P, many complexity theorists find. So I left it as an orange egg in the green P egg here. Okay, catalytic log space, which is a paper that has nothing to do with quantum, but maybe after this week it will. It was with Richard Cleave, Michal Kautsky, Brudolov, and Florian Spielmann. And actually, your thesis is called Quantum Position Verification and Catalytic Log Space. I was looking for it last night, and I forgot that that's the title of your thesis. But
they're both in there, but they're not connected.
No, but we should connect them. I think we should connect them. And here's what this catalytic log space is about. And actually, this is a completely different topic, but I think it's related. It's the following question. Can full memory be of any use? And here's the scenario that we looked at. Suppose that you want to perform a particular computation, and you have a bunch of you have some space available, some hard disk, but at some point you're running out of your hard disk space, right? You want to do the computation, but you just don't have enough space in your computer, right? So ideally you would buy the next version of your computer with more memory and continue, but that's not what's available. What's available to you is another hard disk that is full with other information, like pictures and stuff and whatnot, papers and all kinds of stuff. It's completely full, and you want to keep that information around, but in the meantime, you are allowed to alter that tape while doing your computation, but then at the end of the computation, this information should be returned faithfully, right? It's sort of like a catalyst. You can use it, but you have to return what was there. And so can this extra space be of any help? So here's the model. So you have your input, you have your free space, you have your full space. Then during the space, anything can happen with this content and also with this. And then at the end of the day, this has to be returned to its original setting, and you were able to compute the output. And this, of course, may have changed. And this has to work for every initiation of this space. And let's say for now that we have log n of this free space bits, and we have n or polynomial of this full space bits. Catalytic log space is exactly that. So you have log space freely available, and you have a polynomial amount of space that you can use, but you have to return to its original state. And so first thing you might do is you compress what was on this full space, then use the extra space that you obtained this way for your computation, and then copy the answer of your computation onto your clean space, and then uncompress the space and give it back. But of course, this only works if this space is compressible, but not everything's compressible. Actually, most of the random settings of your catalytic tape is not compressible. So this will not work in general. So second attempt is what sort of comes to mind as a quantum computer scientist, just make your computation reversible. Do your computation, copy the answer, reverse it, and then you have everything back to the beginning. That works well. Use extra tape as normal, then copy the answer when done, and reverse your computation until the beginning. However, that doesn't work because this reversible paradigm requires your initial state to be all zeros. And it wasn't all zeros, it was pictures and all kinds of other things. So it doesn't work either. And so it seems to be completely useless. It's like storing your stuff in the storage that's already full. But it turns out it is actually not useless. And here's how it can be used. So it's actually much more useful than log space. And this is sort of the initial thing that was always on the back of my mind and that somehow helped us develop the algorithms for this. Suppose that you have two registers, X and Y, that you want to swap. You want to swap them. It's easy if you have a third one, right? Because then you just put the value of X into this third register, then you put Y into X, and then you put Z into Y, right? So if you have a third register, you can easily swap them. But as probably many of you know, you can do this also with just two registers. You don't need a third one. And here's how you do it. If you just take your X and you take Y minus X and you put it in there, then the value in X is now TY, which was in X, and TY, which was in Y, and TX, which was in X, and the difference thereof. Then if you do it somehow again, but now with Y, so you sit in Y minus X, then if you now calculate what is in Y, it is the value of T of X. And now if you do X equals Y plus X, then if you calculate what's now in X, it is TY. And so you have swapped the values of X and Y without using a third one. Right? But we had these rules of doing subtraction of registers and adding of registers. and what we were able to show was that all of TC1 can be computed in catalytic log space. And what we used, and this is something that we may have to use also for our position verification thing, we used this thing called transparent computation, which is the following. So you have registers that come from some ring R, and you have registers R0 up to Rm, and some input X. And these registers, they have values from the ring, completely arbitrary values. You cannot set them in the beginning. And you are allowed to do these instructions, namely subtract or add registers from each other and multiply them. And the goal is to, in the end, in the first register, compute the value of F of X, offsetted by the value that was originally there. This is the goal of doing this. And Richard Cleave was very well versed in this game. And note that these programs are actually reversible. Right? If I have an instruction that says add to RI plus RJ times RK, then the inverse of this is just to subtract it. Right? So these things are nicely, beautifully reversible. And now, how can you do, if you have a transparent program for F, then you can actually catalytically compute it. And here's how it works. Here you have your clean space, here you have your catalytic space. First, you divide your catalytic space into registers that somehow are filled with values from your ring. You just interpret it like that. So here you have your registers. And now, first thing you do is you copy the value of R0, T0 in your clean space. Then you run your transparent program P for the value for F. And you can use your clean space to actually do that, to sort of direct it. And then at the end of that transparent computation, the value of F of X is computed in this first register, offsetted by the value of T0. But you stored T0. So if you now subtract T0 from this value, you have F of X. So you extract F of X from these two items and you copy it in your clean part, and now you're left with this catalytic part that's completely changed, but luckily it's reversible now, and so you run the inverse of your program to clean it up, and what you have is the value of F of X that you wanted to compute and the values of your catalytic tape restored to what it was. Right? So you use these transparent algorithms, I'm almost there, and these transparent programs, they're actually quite powerful. We show that you can, with transparent programs, compute TC1. And actually, this is interesting because this is Barrington's theorem in some sense, or an extension of Barrington's theorem that was already noted by Benor and Cleave. I don't know when this was, Richard, but last century. Yeah. And we sort of extended that even further to go all the way up to TC1. But in some sense, this is Barrington's theorem striking back again to give us a slightly more powerful thing. And now I would love, and by the way, this catalytic space in itself has gotten quite interesting. And funnily, the son of Cook, Jay Cook, I forgot his first name, used the, sort of this whole ideas to solve a conjecture that his father, Steve Cook, sort of in Toronto, and Steve Cook is like a famous complexity theorist who started with NP completeness and all that, Cook-Levin's theorem. So this sort of was used by his son to solve a problem of his father using catalytic stuff, using Barrington. So Barrington sort of pops up everywhere. So this catalytic computation in QPV would be very interesting to show that if your function is in catalytic log space, then this F routing can be done for that function with polynomial amount of entanglement. This is something I would love to prove this week, if possible. And it would be interesting because it would go beyond what we know so far about functions and this blob of hierarchy eggs. So can we prove that if it's in catalytic log space, then it's polynomial? Barrington's theorem then would be after all the right tool for this. This is where I want to end it. Sort of ease my mind and show that these quantum garden hose complexity protocols are not so interesting or are equivalent. All the open problems I talked about, E of F, show that there exists an F for which is exponential, or maybe that's not the case. And does there exist one in P for which it has more than polynomial? This should be greater than polynomial entanglement. Connect this catalytic log space with QPV. I think that would be an interesting one. And then I think we should look more at parallel repetitions and like tricks from non-locality that we've learned. And I'm not talking about it, but the implementation, noise, and precision is something that we will hear a lot about this week. And then there should be other primitives other than verification of location that could come out of this. For example, like in combination with QKD, which Florian alluded to, and that seems a little bit different than what you had in mind for your tagging scheme, Adrian. I think it's worthwhile looking at these as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's where I want to leave it for now.
Last question. Your parallel repetition here, so is this just in terms of what do you have in mind here? Is this protocol multiple times?
Exactly, this is what you have to do anyhow, right? Because the if you run it once, you only have a probability of catching the cheater, so you would have to do many times and either sequentially, but ideally in parallel, because if you do them sequentially, then you sort of lose track of. Well, Adrian also said about that, if you do it every microsecond or something, then there's 300 meters. They could have wandered off 300 meters or something. So the best thing you could do is that you do it in one go, because then at least you have that sample point secure. But that would mean parallel repetition of these schemes.
Yeah, I guess following up on that, why do you say like SDP?
I don't know why I said it. I think because in SDPs, sort of in this in non-locality, if you are able to express your game as an STP, actually I think it's also a paper of Richard with Falk and friends, then you can somehow use composition or tensor product of your STPs as an algorithm for the parallel repetition of your game. So sometimes helps expressing these things as STPs and then study parallel repetition in that setting.
Thank you.
Why I said that.
Okay, so lunch will be in the main resource on the first floor, and I'm not sure about that. Might be in the second floor. We'll find it, and yeah, let's thank Harry again.